Hello and welcome to the Politics Home podcast. I'm Matt Honeycomb-Foster, the acting editor here at Politics Home. We've got loads coming up for you on this week's Poll Home podcast. I'll be speaking to Ben Page, a leading pollster, about how the public really feels on lockdown, the government's handling of the crisis, and much, much more. Georgina Bailey, my ace colleague from the House magazine, will be speaking to Baroness Smith, the Labour leader in the Lords, about how a new virtual parliament is working out and how Keir Starmer is faring in the top Labour job. But first, I caught up with Alan Tolhurst, our chief reporter. Alan has just been listening into that major speech from Boris Johnson, setting out his thinking on the coronavirus crisis and the next steps forward. So, Alan, the Prime Minister has just given his major speech on the next steps of the lockdown. It's probably worth starting off with going back a few days and just looking at the run-up to this speech. How's the planning of it been defined?
Well, it's not exactly been vintage government comms, and it was you actually in your one of your breakfast emails this week. Don't forget to subscribe. That pointed out very sort of pithily that, you know, essentially it was that classic issue of over-promising and under-delivering, and really, as soon as the government said that Boris Johnson was going to deliver the speech on Sunday night and was going to talk about a roadmap, was going to talk about unlockdown, which is a horrible word, but, you know, that essentially it kind of got everyone going, especially the press, that he was going to unveil this stuff. And he stood up in the House of Commons on Wednesday at Prime Minister's Questions and talked about he was delivering the speech on a Sunday night because he wanted to get some of these changes enacted straight away from Monday morning, which got everyone's ears pricked up that he was going to announce some fairly substantial changes. And so therefore, when the actual briefing was delivered on Wednesday night for Thursday's papers, and it was a very cautious kind of very minor tweaks to a lot of the guidance, you know, the problem was it was too late, the hairs were already running, and therefore we saw those front pages on Thursday morning talking about happy Monday and lockdown being essentially over. And suddenly, you know, Number 10 spent Thursday and Friday suddenly trying to backpedal and scrabble and say, you know, it's not going to be this. And so therefore, when their message finally did come out, emerged on Saturday night for Sunday's papers, everyone was in a very unreceptive mood. And obviously the stay alert message, which I'm sure we'll come on to, went down very badly. But that's because the pitch was rolled for them in a very bad way. Everyone was kind of set up to not be very happy, given the way that they kind of moved around and changed people's expectations. So it was kind of the warm-up, the warm-up for Boris Johnson's speech was very bad. And so therefore, he was always kind of on a hiding to nothing, given the way that had gone. Essentially, the stay-at-home section of that message is now stay alert, which, you know, everyone's having a lot of fun with, because this idea of what constitutes alertness, as if this virus has an ability to sneak up on you, and unless you stay alert, you know, obviously the idea behind it is to keep the measures that have been in place, the social distancing measures, maintain 2 meter distancing, maintain hand washing, essentially keep to all the principles that have been drummed into us over the past few weeks, but also to start to look where possible to move out of lockdown, to move back towards getting to some sort of semblance of normality. And so one section the Prime Minister spoke about was about people who, you know, currently are not going to work. He obviously said that those people who can work from home should continue to work from home, but anybody who can't should go into work to try and start to reopen those sections of industry and the economy which have been really badly hit by the inability for people to continue to do their jobs and stay within those guidelines.
This is quite a nuanced message then, isn't it, compared to the one that was in place before. Did you get the sense from the speech that the Prime Minister is trying to tell the country that most of this is going to be tentative and it's going to be dependent on the data?
Yeah, absolutely. He repeatedly used the phrase conditional plan, essentially suggesting that whatever he was laying out could immediately be removed if the evidence from the scientific advisors showed that infections, this R rate, which he explained over and over again about how many people can be infected by people if that continues to go back up, obviously we've seen evidence, start of some evidence from Germany where they have unlocked and they have seen some increases in infections. They'll obviously be monitoring that in the next few weeks to see whether that can inform how they move on it. But yeah, essentially, there's a feeling, I think, within government and certainly within the sort of the hawkish elements of it, that this stay at home message ended up being almost too good, that effectively it meant that some people, or a lot of people, were kind of now primed to stay at home for an extended period of time. And there's a feeling that if that lockdown is not lifted and people don't start to re-emerge, obviously in a safe fashion, that actually that's going to have a much more damaging impact on the economy and the state of the country in the months to come, even more so than the virus. So that's why he's trying to sort of dig out of that and trying to shift focus while maintaining some of that same vigilance, but kind of getting people to have a different idea, a different outlook on how things are going to be.
We've seen a few anti-lockdown rumblings now. As you mentioned, there are hawks in the cabinet who are keen to get things moving again as soon as possible. And then obviously backbench critics have been piling on in recent days. Do you think the Prime Minister was trying to address some of that criticism in his speech as well?
Well, he was. He talked about the measures, and he said that they will not be dictated by hope or by economic necessity. And that phrase clearly is aimed at those people who say, you know, look, you have to be starting to move towards lockdown, even if, you know, the science suggests that it's going to have a damaging impact when it comes to infections or mortality, because the economic impact is too deleterious. And so there's talk of, you know, some of his sort of business advisors saying, look, every day that we stay in lockdown, other countries start to come out of lockdown, we're losing out to those countries. And obviously, I think the Prime Minister was trying to sort of tip the hat and say, look, that is an item under consideration. But I think that tentative plan means that can't be the main category for deciding when these measures are lifted.
There's been a big row with Scotland today as well, hasn't there, Alan?
Yes, and then so there's been sort of rumblings about whether, you know, all four nations of the Union are pulling in the same direction or have the same idea about how they want to move forward. And I've sort of not really given it too much attention because I think a lot of it has been sort of manufactured or attempt to sort of find those dividing lines. But clearly this weekend has shown that those kind of dividing lines are definitely there and things have gone pretty badly. We've seen both Scotland and Wales essentially coming out with, if not separate plans, but certainly different focus on the plans. And when it comes to this message, the stay at home message, that will be staying in place in Wales and Scotland. And Nicola Sturgeon sort of pointedly said that she did not want the stay alert message to be used in Scotland and sort of saying to the UK government, look, this is your plan for England, that's your business, but in Scotland it's not going to be like that.
Is number 10 standing by the kind of four nations approach that it's been pushing for a while? Is it still very much the case that you know, Downing Street would like all four nations to move together on this?
Well, I think yes, and this is an administration which has put a premium on maintaining the union in its current guise, and so therefore, you know, I think that I've seen some people, you know, discussing that actually this could become a really deep constitutional crisis. And we kind of thought that maybe something like Brexit would end up having a long lasting impact on the union between the four nations. But actually it could turn out that the coronavirus and the way that is dealt with could be the thing which actually ends up having maybe even a more damaging impact, especially given that where things are going and the divergence that we're currently seeing. You know, obviously in the coming weeks and months, that could get a lot worse. Clearly tensions are there. Number 10, trying to play it down as much as possible. And they suggest that there is still going to be, a UK-wide sort of overarching response. But, you know, obviously the UK government only speaks for England when it comes to these matters, and that Wales and Scotland, and to a lesser extent Northern Ireland, will be able to make their own decisions.
before I let you go and enjoy the dying embers of a bank holiday weekend that nobody really should have spent watching a speech from the Prime Minister, I wondered, do you think the PM has done enough with the speech to regain control of the narrative here?
It's tough to say. I think given, you know, as I said earlier, given the way that the week has gone and the kind of the feeling that they've not got this right, and the kind of the bad reception party for this announcement, it does seem to suggest that it will have done not quite enough to really kind of, you know, dampen people's kind of expectations or been able to fully explain how we're going to go. A lot of people will see some of these easing of restrictions on sunbathing or picnics or exercise and think, well, actually, a lot of people that they've seen, especially in cities, are already doing that. You know, it doesn't feel as though it is a tremendous change. I think things like school openings, obviously we've seen that, you know, in June we could have a few of the years in primary school back, and we could see moves to kind of give years 10 and 12 in secondary school some sort of help for their exams next year and that sort of stuff. And you did mention, you know, hospitality, some aspects of that might be reopening in July, which obviously seems a lot earlier than we've currently been led to expect. We expected sort of that sort of industry to not be reopened until maybe the autumn, although he did, you know, the number 10 were clear that did mean sort of outdoor restaurants, we're not all going to be sort of piling around the bar in our local in July. So he did set out some measures, but I just think that unfortunately, you know, this stay-at-home message did become the sort of the clarion call of the previous stage, and so therefore the stay alert message is now going to become the focal point of the next stage, and that has gone down pretty badly. So I don't imagine the coverage is going to be particularly favorable in the coming days.
Alan, I felt a slight lament from you there at the idea of pubs not reopening again for some time, but I hope you can enjoy unlimited exercise as a consolation.
Thank you very much, Matt. That's great. Yeah.
It's always tempting in politics to make big, broad brush statements about what people do or don't think about something, but for some actual hard data, we still need to go to the pollsters. Ben Page is the chief executive of Ipsos Mori. They've been tracking the public's mood on all aspects of the coronavirus crisis. I caught up with Ben over the phone earlier, and I started by asking him how the public might feel about a return to some semblance of normal life if lockdown measures are eased.
They're very cautious at the moment. So you've got only 1 in 5, so they'd be happy using public transport. Only around half happy to go back to work. And I think that, you know, that people's reaction is in some ways as problematic as the risk of the infections going up again, because it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy about, for the economy at least, that if people are anxious about spending money, then they don't. And then, of course, the economy suffers and then they don't have any money, and it goes on. So the public's pretty pessimistic about when things will go back to normal. You know, you've got 30% who think it will actually be in 2021 that the disease will be contained. And that's up. That was, you know, that's been rising recently. You've got a third who think it will be the autumn, but only 18% of the public at the moment think it'll be during the summer of 2020. So most, you know, most people are sort of in it for the long haul. And, you know, you could argue that the message has been pretty effective about staying home, save lives, etc., protect the NHS, which, of course, the public are positive about. 82% say they're confident in the NHS and what it's done. But basically, people are now very cautious about going out. And, you know, when are you going to feel comfortable in a very crowded restaurant, theatre or cinema? Probably not soon.
Are there any steps that would be more popular than others that people might feel more confident about than perhaps some of the others?
Well, I guess, you know, reopening schools, although I think a lot of parents may keep their children away from schools. So, you know, given that children have a much, much lower rate of infection, that's one possible thing. Opening some smaller shops, given that we're all going to small butchers and things like that, and we don't seem to mind that too much, and there are distancing measures in place. I think it's expecting everybody to turn up at work at 9 o'clock in the morning. That isn't going to happen for a very, very long time. I mean, you know, if you think about how crowded, for example, London Underground is in most of the network in central London, How are you going to run all that with social distancing? People are going to be very anxious about that. And it will only be really, I mean, you know, when the deaths are down to tens a day, not rather than hundreds a day, I think that you might start to see some shift in attitude. I think letting people go out in parks and things like that, I mean, they're already doing it. But, you know, again, where do you draw the line? And I think it'll be this iterative process where we see what happens, given that in Germany they relaxed it slightly and the infection rate went up again.
Are there any generational divides at play here? Do younger people feel more confident about any kind of phased return to normal life than perhaps elderly?
They are overall, the young are a bit more confident, and you know, that's given that they're less likely to die from it. You can sort of understand that. They're also more likely to be living in crowded accommodation, and they're more likely to be on, you know, either being furloughed or made redundant, you know, unemployed, finding it hard to make ends meet. So you can see why younger people are sort of more want to get out. They're in more crowded accommodation, et cetera. So, you know, undoubtedly, those are the people you'll see sunbathing today in the parks, not the 70 pluses.
Well, what about the government's response itself, Ben? Is there a feeling that ministers have the situation under control, and how has that perception evolved over time?
Well, people have actually become more critical. It's an interesting, they've become more critical of the government's actual response. So the proportion saying that they were too late has been rising, and is now 66% of us saying that the government was too late going into lockdown. But of course, at the same time, which you see in all sorts of crises and wars, support for the government has gone up. Ratings of the prime minister have gone up by about 16 percentage points since the crisis began. And we've seen that across Europe. It's the same for Conte, Macron. Mrs. Merkel walks on water in Germany. The last time I looked, she had 79% satisfied with her performance, which basically means she's God to any politician. So people are critical of the government and of supplies of PPE, yet at the same time, support for the government and indeed even trust in the government has risen. But how much of that is a temporary thing for the crisis, I think, remains to be seen.
How is Keir Starmer faring in his response to the pandemic? Is he on the public radar at all?
Well, not particularly. There was one survey we did relatively recently that asked, you know, how much confidence you had in different people holding the government to account. So if you were leader of the opposition, you'd hope to be doing very well on that. And in his first couple of weeks as leader, he had only 24% of people saying that he was doing a good job holding the government to account. Piers Morgan had 29%, and journalists had... But at the same time, it's early days. He's got to cut through. I think the fact that he's got I'm not sure if it's a front page, but it looked like it on social media to me today, a story in this, you know, he's written in the Daily Telegraph of all titles about VE Day, shows just how differently he's positioning himself to his predecessor, and how much more he may ultimately appeal to the mainstream. At the moment, he has more people who are positive than negative towards him, which is good, but he has most people haven't made up their mind yet. And he of course, is going to find it difficult to get general airtime and cut through.
Ben, you mentioned some findings on journalists there, and obviously in the lobby, we love some self-indulgent navel gazing. Number 10's claim that the public confidence in journalists and the media has collapsed during the pandemic.
I think that's an unfortunate remark. I mean, there isn't really any evidence of that. There's a tracker that is being done every week by Ofcom asking how much confidence do you have in the BBC, the broadcasters, papers, etc. And what that shows is, 70% plus say that they trust the BBC and the other main broadcasters. And although print journalists in Britain are a little bit less trusted than TV journalists, the long-term trends suggest that it's pretty stable. So I think that, unfortunately, is wishful thinking from number 10. And of course, it very much depends how you ask the questions. If you ask about newspapers versus Boris Johnson at a time of national crisis, then lots of people will say they support the prime minister over the newspapers. But actually, if you ask who do you trust to give you information about the crisis, then the media are doing okay.
Zooming out a little bit, then to the wider impact of the crisis. Is there any sense from the data that you've been looking at that people feel this has been a leveller in any sense, that there's been a kind of equal impact across society?
Well, no, simply. I mean, what we actually see is that most people say that, you know, the old and the poor and people in big cities are going to suffer more than others. And of course, the data, when you look at how many people are dying by the level of deprivation in local authorities, you know, the pattern is pretty clear that black and minority ethnic and poor people are suffering disproportionately. You know, I mean, imagine being with three kids, one laptop in a small council flat with no garden, and somebody else is in a nice big house and has enough money and in a big house, nice garden. You know, you can see how it, can just imagine how it plays out differently. So no, I mean, I think, you know, the country is united in its support for the NHS and broadly is united in wanting to make sure that it tackles the virus together and does the right thing. There's a little bit more quarantine breaking in younger, more working class households. But generally, the nation's held together on that. But in terms of who's affected and who's dying, there are some very pretty stark statistics, I think.
What research should we be looking out for from Ipsos Mori over the next few weeks?
Well, we'll keep tracking public opinion, particularly towards the lockdown and whether that's changing and people are becoming more relaxed and more confident. We'll keep tracking attitudes to the government. And of course, we're now working on behalf of the government to actually send out swabs and potentially soon antigen testing in order to get as part of this large national effort to have a population studies that allow us to see, you know, who's got it at the moment and potentially who's been exposed to it and has antibodies. And that will help inform, you know, the government strategy on when we should actually be allowed out. So watch out for all of that.
Georgina Bailey is the policy editor of The House magazine, and she joins me to talk about her interview with Baroness Angela Smith. A very warm welcome to the pod again, Georgina. How are you doing?
Oh, yeah, I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for having me again.
So who is Baroness Angela Smith, Georgina?
She was formerly the Labour MP for Basildon from 1997 to 2010, but now she has played a leadership role on the Labour benches in the Lords since 2015. So firstly, I kind of spoke about actually what does the shadow leader of the Lords do in normal times?
It's hard to remember so-called normal times now, but I suppose it's an unusual role because there's no equivalent in the House of Commons. So it is both a political role and a management and business management role. So in some ways, I would be part of the role of the shadow leader of the House in the House of Commons and part of the role as a shadow leader of the party in the House of Commons. So it's enormously varied, and it's a role that's elected by my Labour colleagues. So I've been doing it for the last 5 years, and it's hard to describe what it is because there's no 2 days ever the same.
Do you enjoy it?
I love doing it. That's not to say there aren't days that are hugely frustrating, but I can think of nothing else I'd rather do, and perhaps do it in government rather than opposition.
So obviously the Lords has had to adapt, like we all have, to the coronavirus crisis, and we've spoken before quite extensively about the changes in the Commons, but what role's Baroness Smith been playing in that Lords overhaul?
So as a member of the House of Lords Commission, she was quite involved over the Easter recess in talking out what the new plans were for moving to a virtual Lords, and now obviously she's a key part of keeping the government to account on what changes are adapting and how they're moving forwards.
It's interesting how people responded to it as well, because the challenges are both political and technological. I think the House has sort of upped its game enormously in terms of technology and moved quite quickly to an almost fully virtual system, with some business still being in the chamber, but not in the House of Commons, being both in the chamber and virtual at the same time. They've been different times. But it's also, I suppose, how you manage business, because with you've got to allow different timings, you've got people taking part in a different way, your procedure is going to be the same. So if I could sum it up in some ways, it would be meetings, 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 and perhaps at the same time trying to get that political role in there, because the reason we want to continue with our work is that political role and that constitutional role of holding the government to account, engaging with policy, and in the House of Lords way, trying to be useful in that role. And to bring in the politics and technology together isn't always easy. It's been challenging at times, but I think my colleagues have responded really well. I think in terms of, you know, there was a time when if anyone left the call, their number or their name came up, and that was because they were on a telephone system rather than because the iPads didn't connect when we did Teams. So that's been resolved. And I think we have to keep it under constant review how we're working. And for me, and I think for others, we're learning about technology all the time and learning from the experts. And at all times we have to feed in, how do we use technology to do our work better? And that's under constant review and constant discussion.
Georgina, she was pretty dismissive, wasn't she, of any suggestion that the over 65s might end up being kept away from the Lords. What's that row all about?
So over last weekend, the Sunday Times were briefed quite extensively that the government was going to stop over 65s from being part of the Lords until the coronavirus was over, potentially for their own good. And there was some concern that this was a wider move to get rid of people who are over 65 from the Lords altogether, which is the majority of the Lords. Now, this has since been dismissed by the government, but yeah, Angela Smith was not happy about it.
I think the story, though it's been dismissed by ministers, it should never have seen the light of day. You know, I'd scrape it under that, just a bit under 65. But I have to say, what message that sends to anybody who's 65 and over that the government felt it was appropriate to brief that they could get rid of 65s and over. I think the minister said it was a third-rate story, but to me, it belongs to the same stable as saying the House of Lords is going to move to York. As much as I love the city of York, I think Parliament has to be seen as a whole, and the role of the House of Lords as part of the whole of Parliament, working with MPs in the House of Commons. It's interesting about House of Lords reform, because the people who have been most vocal about wanting reform of the House of Lords have been members of the House of Lords themselves. And indeed, we've looked at ways through the Burns report has been agreed by the House of Lords of reducing the size of the House of Lords. As a second chamber, I think we have a value and a use in examining the detail of legislation. And I sometimes describe it as, in the House of Commons, they often get the political arguments and the broad thrust and some of the detail. We then look at legislation and the fine print. And one of the biggest things we look at, is this exactly right? Is it will it work in practice? And then us House of Commons have another look and see if they agree with the concerns and the issues we've raised. So it's a supportive role. And I'm surprised actually the government doesn't recognise that more and actually appreciate it a little more. Perhaps it's because we've been quite critical of some government actions as a House. Yeah. But that's not a party political issue. That's about getting the best legislation, and that cuts across all parties in the second chamber.
And of course, Keir Starmer is also settling into his first few weeks as Labour leader. He's been trying to hold the government to account on the coronavirus pandemic. What did you learn from Angela Smith on how he's faring in the job?
So Angela Smith was a Keir Starmer supporter all along, and unsurprisingly, she's actually pretty happy with how things are going. I did ask her a little bit more about that.
In the Shadow Cabinet a long time now. I was in the Shadow Cabinet before Jeremy Corbyn as well, and as a Member of Parliament, when I was the PPS for Gordon Brown, I sat in on Cabinet meetings. So I've seen a lot of changes. I'm really impressed with Keir. I think as a new leader, he has taken over in one of the most difficult times, both for his party, having had successive election defeats, and a particularly unpleasant election defeat last year, but also such a difficult time for the country. And the way he has responded to that, in what he's looking at in terms of COVID, the future economy, what the country looks like post this crisis, shows to me that he's got that kind of thought process that is thinking ahead and thinking strategically. But at the same time, he's also working within the Labour Party to give confidence to people about the approach we're taking. So I find Keir's approach inclusive. I think his approach to his politics is forensic and thoughtful. I think he has a very decent approach, an honest approach to things. And I have to say, I am enjoying the shadow cabinet meetings and work with my new colleagues. One of the interesting things I think always about leaders, particularly new leaders, is who do they want around them? And I'm always impressed when a leader wants the smartest and the brightest and the nicest people around them. And that's what Keir has done with his new shadow cabinet.
Well, that's all we've got time for on the Politics Home podcast this week. Thanks very much as ever for listening and subscribing. And as of this week's episode, if you fancy getting a question into us, you can record that as a voicemail. We'll send the link to that in the notes for this episode and on our Twitter feed. So if you fancy getting your voice on the podcast among the stars, you certainly can do. Thank you for listening and keep well.